Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Leviticus 21, Parasha of Emor. The Lord said to Moses, saying, "Say to the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron, and tell them, each of you shall not contaminate himself to a dead person among his people, except for the relative who is closest to him, to his mother, to his father, to his son, to his daughter, and to his brother, and to his virgin sister who is close to him, who has not been wed to a man yet. To her he shall contaminate himself. A husband among his people shall not contaminate himself to one who desecrates him. They shall not make a bald spot on their heads. They shall not shave an edge of their beard. In their flesh they shall not cut a gash. They shall be holy to their God. They shall not desecrate the name of their God. The fire offerings of the Lord, the food of their God, they offer. So they must remain holy. They shall not marry a woman who is a harlot or has been desecrated. And they shall not marry a woman who has been divorced by her husband, for each one is holy to his God. You shall sanctify him, for he offers the food of your God, and he shall remain holy to you. For holy am I, the Lord, who sanctifies you. If the daughter of a Kohen will be desecrated through adultery, she desecrates her father. She shall be consumed by the fire. The Kohen who is exalted above his brethren, upon whose head the anointment oil has been poured, or who has been inaugurated to don on the vestments, shall not leave his head uncut, and shall not rend his garments. He shall not come near any dead person. He shall not contaminate himself to his father or his mother. He shall not leave the sanctuary, he shall not desecrate the sanctuary of his God. For a crown, the oil of his God's anointment, is upon him. I am the Lord. He shall marry a woman in her virginity, a widow, a divorcee, a desecrated woman, a harlot. He shall not marry these. Only a virgin of his people shall he take as a wife. Thus shall he not desecrate his offspring among his people, for I am the Lord, who sanctifies him." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron, saying, any man of your offspring throughout your generations, in whom there will be a blemish, shall not come near to offer the food of his God. For any man in whom there is a blemish shall not approach. A man who is blind or lame, or whose nose has no bridge, or has one limb longer than the other, or in whom there will be a broken leg or a broken arm, who has abnormally long eyebrows, or a membrane over his eye, or a blemish in his eye, or dry skin eruptions, or moist skin eruptions, or has crushed testicles. A man from among the offspring of Aaron the Kohen who has a blemish shall not approach the offering for the fire offerings of the Lord. He has a blemish. The food of his God he shall not approach to offer. The food of his God from the most holy and from the holy he may eat, but he shall not come to the curtain. He shall not approach the altar, for he has a blemish. He shall not desecrate my sacred offerings, for I am the Lord, who sanctifies them." Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the children of Israel. Chapter 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons. They shall withdraw from the holies of the children of Israel that which they sanctify to me, so as not to desecrate my holy name. I am the Lord. Say to them, throughout your generations, any man from among any of your offspring who shall come near the holies, that the children of Israel may sanctify to the Lord with his contamination upon him, that person shall be cut off from before me. I am the Lord. Any man from the offspring of Aaron who is a Metzora or a Zav shall not eat from the holies until he becomes purified. One who touches anyone contaminated by a corpse, or a man from whom there is a seminal emission, or a man who touches any swarming thing through which he can become contaminated, or a person through whom he can become contaminated, whatever his contamination may be, the person who touches it shall be contaminated until evening. He shall not eat from the holies unless he has immersed his body in water. After the sun is set, he shall become purified. Thereafter he may eat from the holies, for it is his food. He shall not eat from a carcass or from a torn animal to be contaminated through it. I am the Lord. They shall protect my charge and not bear a sin thereby and die because of it, for they will have desecrated it. I am the Lord who sanctifies them. No layman shall eat of the holy. One who resides with a Kohen or his laborer shall not eat of the holy. If a Kohen shall acquire a person and acquisition of his money, he may eat of it. And someone born in his home, they may eat of it. If a Kohen's daughter shall be married to a layman, she may not eat of the separated holies. And the Kohen's daughter, who will become a widow or a divorcee and not have offspring, she may return to her father's home as in her youth, and she may eat from her father's food. But no layman may eat of it. If a man will eat of the holy inadvertently, he shall add its fifth to it, and shall repay the holy to the priest. They shall not desecrate the holies of the children of Israel, which they set aside to the Lord. And they will cause themselves to bear the sin of guilt when they eat the holies. For I am the Lord who sanctifies them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and to his sons, to all the children of Israel, and say to them, Any man of the house of Israel and the proselytes among Israel who will bring his offering for any of their vows or their freewill offerings, they will bring to the Lord for a burnt offering, to be favorable for you, must be unblemished, male from the cattle, the flock, or the goats. Any in which there is a blemish you shall not offer, for it will not be favorable for you. And a man who will bring a feast peace offering to the Lord because of an articulated vow or as a free will offering from the cattle or the flock, it shall be unblemished to find favor. There shall not be any blemish in it. One that is blind or broken with a split eyelid or a wart or a dry skin eruption or moist skin eruption, you shall not offer these to the Lord. You shall not place any of them as a fire offering on the altar of the Lord. An ox or a sheep that has one limb longer than the other, or unsplit hooves, you may make as a donation, but it is not acceptable as a vow offering. One whose testicles are squeezed, crushed, torn, or cut, you shall not offer to the Lord, nor shall you do these in your land. From the hand of a stranger, you may not offer the food of your God from any of these, for their corruption is in them, a blemish is in them. And they will not find favor for you. The Lord told Moses, saying, When an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain under its mother for 7 days. From the 8th day on, it is acceptable as a fire offering to the Lord. But an ox or sheep or a goat, you may not slaughter it and its offspring on the same day. When you slaughter a feast thanksgiving offering to the Lord, you shall slaughter it to gain favor for yourselves. It must be eaten on that same day. You should not leave any of it until morning. I am the Lord. You shall observe all my commandments and perform them. I am the Lord. You shall not desecrate my holy name. Rather, I should be sanctified among the children of Israel. For I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who took you out of the land of Egypt to be a God unto you. I am the Lord. Chapter 23. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, The Lord's appointed festivals, that you are to designate as holy convocations, these are my appointed festivals. For 6 days labor may be done, on the 7th day, a day of complete rest, a holy convocation. You should not do any work, it is a Sabbath, the Lord in all your dwelling places. These are the appointed festivals of the Lord, the holy convocations which you shall designate in their appropriate time. In the first month, on the 14th of the month, in the afternoon, is the time of the Pesach offering to the Lord. On the 15th day of this month is the festival of Matzot to the Lord. You shall eat Matzot for a 7-day period. On the first day, there will be a holy convocation for you. You shall do no laborious work. You shall bring a fire offering to the Lord for a 7-day period. On the 7th day, shall also be a holy convocation to you. should no cut laborious work. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, When you shall enter the land that I give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring an omer from your first harvest to the priest. He shall wave the omer before the Lord to gain favor for you. On the morrow of the rest day, the Kohen shall wave it. On the day you wave the omer, you shall perform the service of an unblemished lamb in its first year as a burnt offering to the Lord. Its meal offering shall be 2/10 ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, a fire offering to the Lord, a satisfying aroma, and its libation shall be wine, a quarter hin. You shall not eat any bread or roasted kernels or plump kernels until this day, until you bring the offering to the Lord your God. It is an eternal decree for all your generations and all your dwelling places. You shall count for yourselves from the morrow of the rest day, from the day in which you bring the omer offering, 7 weeks. They shall be complete. Until the morrow of the 7th week, you shall count 50 days. You shall offer a new meal offering to the Lord. For your dwelling places, you shall bring bread that shall be weighed, 2 loaves made with 2/10 ephah, maybe should be made of fine flour. They should be baked leavened. First offerings to the Lord. With the bread you shall offer 7 unblemished lambs in their first year, 1 young bull, 2 rams. This should be a burnt offering to the Lord, with their meal offering and their libations, a fire offering, a satisfying aroma. You should make one he-goat as a sin offering, 2 lambs in their first year as feast peace offerings. The Kohen shall wave them upon the first offering of the breads as a wave serves before the Lord upon the 2 sheep. They shall be holy for the Lord and for the priest. You shall convoke on this very day. There shall be a holy convocation for yourselves. You shall do no laborious work. It is an eternal decree in your dwelling places for your generations. When you reap the harvest of your land, you should not remove completely the corners of your field as you reap. Should not gather the gleanings of your harvest. For the poor and the proselyte that shall you leave them. I am the Lord your God. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, say in the 7th month, on the 1st of the month, there should be a rest day for you, a remembrance with shofar blasts, a holy convocation. You should not do any laborious work, and you shall offer a fire offering to the Lord. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, But on the 10th day of this month, the 7th month, is the Day of Atonement. There shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall afflict yourselves. You shall offer a fire offering to the Lord. You shall not do any work on this very day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to provide for you atonement before the Lord your God. Any soul who will not be afflicted on this very day will be cut off from his people. Any soul who will do any work on this day, I will destroy that soul from among its people. You shall not do any work. It is an eternal decree throughout your generations, in all your dwelling places. It is a day of complete rest for you. You shall afflict yourselves on the 9th of the month in the evening. From evening to evening, you shall rest on your rest day. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying on the 15th day of the 7th month is the festival of Sukkot, a 7-day period for the Lord. On the first day is a holy convocation. You should not do any laborious work. For a 7-day period you shall offer a fire offering to the Lord. On the 8th day there should be a holy convocation for you, and you shall offer a fire offering to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall not do any laborious work. These the appointed festivals of the Lord that you shall proclaim as holy convocations to offer a fire offering to the Lord, a burnt offering and its meal offering, a feast offering and its libation, each day's requirement on its day. Aside from the Lord's Sabbaths, aside from your gifts, aside from all your vows, aside from all your freewill offerings, which you will present to the Lord. On the 15th day of the 7th month, when you gather in the crop of the land, you shall celebrate the Lord's festival for a 7-day period. The first day is a rest day, and the 8th day is a rest day. You shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of a goodly tree, the branches of date palms, twigs, a plaited tree, and brook willows. You shall rejoice before the Lord your God for your 7-day period. You shall celebrate it as a festival of the Lord, a 7-day period in that year, an eternal decree for all your generations. In the 7th month shall you celebrate it. You shall dwell in booths for that 7-day period. Every native in Israel shall dwell in booths, so that your generation will know that I caused the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I took them from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Moses declared the appointed festivals of the Lord to the children of Israel. Chapter 24. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel that they shall take for you pure olive oil, pressed for illumination, to kindle a continual lamp. Outside the partition of testimony in the tent of meeting, Aaron shall arrange it from evening to morning before the Lord continually, an eternal decree for your generations. On the pure menorah shall be arranged the lamps before the Lord continually. You shall take fine flour and bake it into 12 loaves. Each loaf shall be 2/10 ephah. You shall place them in 2 stacks, 6 in each stack, upon the pure table before the Lord. You shall put pure frankincense on each stack, and it shall be a remembrance for the Lord, a fire offering to the Lord. Each and every Shabbat, he shall arrange them before the Lord continually, for the children of Israel as an eternal covenant. It shall belong to Aaron and his sons. They shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy for him, from the fire offering of the Lord, an eternal decree. Now the son of an Israelite woman went out, and he was a son of an Egyptian man among the children of Israel. They fought in the camp, the son of the Israelite woman and an Israelite man. Now the son of the Israelite woman pronounced the name and blasphemed it. So they brought him to Moses. The name of his mother was Shulamit, daughter of Divri of the tribe of Dan. They placed him under guard to clarify for themselves through the Lord what should be done. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, remove the blasphemer who is outside of the camp, and all those who heard him shall lean their hands upon his head. The assembly shall stone him. And the children of Israel ye shall speak, saying, any man who will blaspheme his God shall bear his sin. And one who pronounced blasphemy, the name of the Lord, shall be put to death. The entire assembly shall surely stone him. The proselyte and native alike, when he blasphemes the name, he shall be put to death. And a man, if he strikes mortally any human life, he shall also be put to death. A man who strikes mortally an animal life shall make restitution, life for life. If a man inflicts a wound in his fellow, as he did, so shall be done to him. A break for a break, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he will have inflicted a wound on a person, so shall he be inflicted upon him. One who strikes an animal shall make restitution. One who strikes a person shall be put to death. There shall be one law for you. It shall be for the proselyte and native alike, for I, the Lord, am your God. Moses spoke to the children of Israel and took the blasphemy to the house of the camp. They stoned him. The children of Israel did as the Lord had commanded Moses. A lot of reading. I'm going to erase this because this is the contact information for the Azure people. So that was Leviticus chapter 21, 2, 3, and 4. Also, as Emor is the name of it, which means to say, or speak, or tell. Before I go into my little talk and discussions about this reading section, any comments, questions, or opinions that caught your eye that you want to ask or a question? Yes.
How big were the corners of the field?
How big were the corners of the field? I have no idea how big the corners of the field were. I had to measure the field. Each field had its own corner. If you ever get like a chance to look at a Google map, like not like a map, like the Google Earth views, and you'll see a lot of in the farm areas, they have two different forms of farms they manufacture. There's the round and the square. So you may have, you know, roads and, you know, country roads of all different shapes and sizes going every which way. And these could be a quarter mile, half mile long, who knows? Well, depending on what the farmer chooses to do, he may choose to plant all of his field, and you'll see the little Google Maps are green, straight corner to corner to corner. In this case, he's referring to the corners here to leave. There's also some farmers, because it is economically more feasible in the way which their sprinkling system works and how things to work, is to ignore the corners, make a completely round or circular field. So everything's completely circular. There are no corners. It's always completely done. In this particular circular field format, it's convenient when it comes to watering. If you've seen the big wheels, they're like, look like old wagon wheels with these pipes going through this. Well, those, if they station the beginning where the water source is, they can rotate around in a circle all the way around and gets the whole field all nice and taken care of and everything's all nice and wet. And so they can literally make a section in the middle of where the water source is and make these pipes half mile long in some cases and just slowly rotate them as they go around sprinkling all the field, making it all nice and green. It also makes it very convenient for running a tractor for harvesting because you're just going around in circles. There's no turning or stirring around. So when you refer to the corner of a field, for in these four corners, if you have a square field. More importantly, it's the gleaning point they want you to catch. The corners is another way of wording that is the gleanings. Is another way of viewing it. What glean means, right? Glean means bit. That's the term of grabbing a little bit. Those of you who are familiar with computerized systems, bits are the smallest unit of measure, the one or the zero. And then there's bytes, when there's eight of them, it grows from to megabytes and kilobytes, and there's all different values of them. Bit is the tiniest amount. So when it's referred to the corners or the gleanings, don't take every little bit, every little grape, every little raisin, or whatever you're happy to harvesting. Don't take every one of them. That's taking bits. That's called gleaning. Don't do that. You go through once with your harvesters, everything else, leave. Don't touch it, don't go back and harvest it again, or gather anything that wasn't quite ripe yet. No, it's gone. It's a one-time shot. The idea is, well, if the poor people who don't have land, they don't have ways of providing for themselves, but they also want the same blessings God has poured upon the countryside. He's rain, he's got a lot of good sunlight, all these various good things he's done to help the country to prosper and grow. They don't have the option of growing much in their own hovels, wherever they happen to live, in the set of a city, because that's what they can afford, because they're renters. They want them to benefit from the same land that's being left over. So the idea of leaving the corners and the gleanings is, don't take every component. That's not what God intended. So that's the idea behind the corners and gleanings. Leave a section or a portion of it. How big does it have to be? I don't know. I don't know how big the corners have to be. I don't own property. But you can probably take a stab at it as far as when have you gone too far? When have you taken every bit and when have you not? There's a good example when it comes to Ruth, in the book of Ruth, discussing the same exact topic. When she comes along with Boaz's men to harvest, and she's coming along with the gleaning, she's gathering anything the harvesters couldn't take. So they cut a large swath, well, some of the grain will fall, or some stalks will fall. They don't go pick them up because that's not cost effective. Your job is to harvest as quickly as you can. Whatever falls, ignore it, keep on going. But she comes along and gathers up whatever's left. And Boaz, because he took favor upon her, told his men, even if she grabs a bigger stock, it's okay, let her take it, because he happened to like her. But that's a different story. But the idea is to share the abundance that God has blessed this land with, not just your own personal farm, but all the countryside, with those who don't have the ability to receive that same blessing. Does that make sense? So the size of corner isn't really the relevant point, so much as it's the concept behind it. What are you doing? Are you sharing what is freely given to you? Because you didn't pay for the rain. That obviously came. You didn't pay for the sun. That came. All those things were free items that God blessed you with. The land you may have bought, or may have inherited, or even worked to plant it, but the blessing that God gave to allow it to grow wasn't your doing. That was His doing. He wants you to share His blessing with those who could not have received that blessing. Regardless of the size of the corners, it's still the idea of sharing it with those who don't have any. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions or comments? Things to answer for you? Yes.
So we start off with the death of maybe what family member that you will help to clean or
take care of the dead body.
Ceremony.
Right.
And then in the end, we're ending up with the rehashing of the commandments, if That's not true. Or some of the commandments.
Rehashing. Rehashing.
Well, maybe the word is not good, rehash, but I mean a summing up again about those things that would cause death.
Right, a number of things. They gave various examples as far as reason for punishment for death penalties. Not every example is listed, but a number of them are. Right. It does do a rundown of what death penalties required to allowing a dead body to occur. Yes, it does start out with as far as contamination through dead bodies and how you are not allowed to do so. The only person who is prohibited from touching a dead body, regardless of who they are, is the high priest himself. It doesn't matter if it's his mom or his dad or his son or his daughter. It makes a difference. He doesn't touch it. It's done. It's a separate thing. There is the one fundamental example which in Jewish tradition says overweighs this particular law for even the high priest. If you're in the middle of nowhere and there's no one around and you see a dead body, regardless of how clean or committed you are, bury it. Never leave a body unburied, regardless of what your personal circumstances are. If there is someone else around to do it, or you can notify to do it, and you're a high priest, that's your job. Go notify them, there's a dead body over there, go bury it. But if there's nobody else around, say, hey, it's better off to have the person buried than not buried. Does that make sense? That's the one exception which Judaism does allow for the high priest in particular. Yes?
Well, going along with that, so in the story of the Good Samaritan, although the was the priest and a Levite that walked past and left them there. So it kind of gives you a little different look at it. They weren't just being, ew, I don't want to touch that. They were, you know.
They were trying to obey their instructions to some degree. Now,
but they should have gone.
They should have done, because he wasn't dead yet.
Right,
he wasn't dead yet.
They should have checked.
That's the deal. They should have checked. And that is also responsibility. If obviously in the parable the Messiah gives with those three characters, they're walking past the road from, I guess, Jericho to Jerusalem, I think, is the road, the highway he uses in his story, which is at the time was a relatively notorious, difficult road to travel. The idea is you have to check if the body's alive or dead. You don't necessarily have to go over there and contaminate yourself. You can at least check if the person's died or alive or dead without actually physically touching them. It could have easily been done. And it points out that the priest walked by and a Levite walked by. He didn't just say the high priest walked by. So a priest can walk by, and is there more leniency on the priest in particular? Although the priest specifically states you were allowed for your mother, your father, your son, your unmarried daughter, and your sister, a virgin sister, and your brother. So the priest, an ordinary priest who isn't a high priest, the anointed one above everybody else, he contaminated his self for various reasons as his job required or is needed. This is assuming that there's nobody else that can do it. Now, there are actually examples in which we talked about two weeks ago, in the book of Amos, which Amos points out that there'll be, 1,000 go out and 100 will come back and 10 will be in a room and they'll all be dead. And there's nobody else to bury. There's just a few people left to actually. You're not going to find somebody else to do the job. Whether you're a priest or not, go bury the dead bodies. You never allow a body to be unburied. So in Amos's example, regardless of what's going on, there's nobody else around. You have to do the job. And the case for the example the Messiah gives with the priest, the Levite, and the Samaritan, obviously the man wasn't dead yet. Close, wasn't dead yet. They could have checked. And it's not that you cannot contaminate yourself for a live person who needs help. You can do that. If the dead person who needs help, who's already dead, that's where your limitation is. That's the idea of the boundaries. And so in that example, he gave the two who walked on by, took their basic instruction to the next step level, which was beyond what he instructed. They took it, well, he's almost dead, I'll leave him alone. Well, that's not what he said. it's the dead body that's referred to, not the, he's in beat up really bad, and he could die if I don't, it's not that part, it's the actual dead part. So in the example he gave, he pointed out that both those two individuals broke not only the spirit of the law, but actually the letter too, because they didn't help somebody, which they could have easily helped, without contaminating themselves. They chose not to do it. Now there's the other issue, they could be contaminated with blood. A human blood is also contaminant too. And I don't know what the man's body condition happened to have been in. He could have been bloodied, I don't know. But that is a wash yourself, and in the evening you're done. And it wasn't the high priest. So if even a Levite who wasn't a high priest had said, hey, I have a service to do, but I can't do it, there are lots and lots of priests. Only one high priest, but lots and lots of priests. So they could have said, hey, I'm out for the day. You do go on without me to continue on and take care of my service. So there are lots of options for the two men, the examples that he gave, and they obviously did not choose to do any of them. Hope it makes sense. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, it seems like the Lord is pretty stern in some of his regulations. But in your book, it said if one strikes another, then
right.
you are to kill him.
Right.
Put him to death. And in my translation, it says this, if you kill him, you
right.
are to put him. So apparently it's in the translation.
Yeah.
What they mean?
Strike in order to kill.
In order to kill, premeditated or,
yes.
or not premeditated.
It's a strike with the objective to kill.
It's murder.
It's murder. Yeah. Whether the person actually died at that moment in time or dies later, the point is that you attempted to kill someone, and that was your objective. That was to strike to kill. The person may have died or may not have died. If they didn't die, you could argue, well, the guy didn't die. Well, there's always a court of law that each one of these cases is always brought before. And it points out that when he strikes the whole eye for eye, tooth for tooth, at the end of 24, I think it is, or 25, 24, that is also punishment that is dished out only after a trial has been occurred. So you can't say, oh, he hit me, so I hit him back. It doesn't work that way. He hit me, I bring him to court. Okay, the court says, what happened? Who are the witnesses? What happened with the circumstances? Who did what and why did they do it? Now, here's the punishment. The court is limited as far as what punishment can they distribute upon this person, no more than whatever you just did to this other individual. There's a limitation. Yes?
Could they, in charity, say, okay, this person knocked out my tooth. I don't want that to happen to the other person.
Forgiveness is always permitted, yes. The idea is that there's a limitation. You cannot go beyond whatever the person did. They knocked a tooth out, you can't, break their jaw. You went beyond what they did for the punishment. Forgiveness or leniency on anything is always permitted. That's a guaranteed right. Because God says he is merciful. If he looked at our sins and corrected us for all of our sins, we'd all be dead. So the mercy of God says, hey, I'm going to weaken the justified punishment to make it not so severe on you so you will continue on in your growth and continue on growing, as you want for anyone to do. You always throw yourself the mercy of the court, so to speak. That is a fundamental right as far as God's and how he distributed his corrections throughout history and how he instructed people to do. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Let's see here. All right, let's jump into this. So, we'll start early on in chapter 21. We're discussing the whole contaminating your body, contaminating your person for a dead body, that kind of thing, who can, who can't, all those details. In this instance, you will note the idea of contaminating is you are willingly doing so. But you willingly contaminate yourself. Because there is an optional person, if there is anything else around, because this is the idea. When it says that here, it says, for a person, it's verse 1. It says, each of you shall not contaminate himself to a dead person among his people. What does that mean, among his people? That does not mean out in the field, in the middle of nowhere. Among his people means inside your dwelling places, inside your cities, inside your towns, inside your villages, among his people. So the idea of contaminating yourself willingly to a dead body. The dead person died inside the confines of the town or the village or the building where there's people around. This is not out in the field. So the dead person died among people. If he died among people, are there people around who can take care of the dead body? Yes. There are actually people who are hired to do just that. Their job, we call them coroners today. At that time, they're called the burners. They actually burn the dead bodies, or they bury them in whatever way was appropriate, depending on what the death situation was. So when you say among his people, means you're not out in the middle of the field of nowhere, and there's nobody around for 10,000 miles. It's referring to, it's within the places you dwell, your house, it could be your house, but your city, your town. If you choose, as a priest, to contaminate yourself, and it was not amongst the, your father, your mother, your son, your daughter, who is unmarried, and your sister, your brother, then you've chosen beyond your permitted allowance. Your allowance is, if it's among your people, go call somebody and say, hey, I have a dead body here, take care of it. Go get someone, take care of the dead body. Don't willingly contaminate yourself unnecessarily. Make sense? Why? What does it matter? What is that? Say it loud, say it louder.
The face of God.
They are supposed to be God's representative. They're supposed to be offering all the offerings to people before God at all times. If a priest, not say the high priest, because we're just going to say that later, if a priest is saying, I have this job to do of all these people I'm supposed to offer their offerings this week, or I'm assigned for this task for the month, and he said, well, I could do that, or I could take care of this dead body over here. You've then made a judgment call saying the offerings of these other people who are alive, their vows, their feeble offerings, their needs, their prayers, the things offered, they take care of their sins. You're saying, those aren't important to me, as opposed to this dead body who I'm not related to is. You took a dead person and placed them above a live person's needs. High priests are not supposed to do that. Yes.
So, was it normal during those times to allow the sick or the elderly to die in their homes?
That's generally how it was done, yes.
How does this apply then?
Well, if a sick or elderly person dies in their homes, it's assuming that there are relatives that exist. If there are no relatives that exist, that's a different story you have to deal with. If I have to go back and find distant relatives who can take care of the body. And usually, typically, it landed upon an uncle's job to go take care of whatever the dead body was. It was usually the uncle or a brother, it was his task to take care of dead bodies inside of a home. That was his job. It didn't have to be an uncle necessarily, but it was usually a male did the work. And it was usually a male relative, an uncle's most common one. So if someone is sick or is dying in their own home, which is commonly done, allow you to die in your own home, which is fine. But then who takes care of the body is usually a close enough relative who has the physical ability, strength-wise, to pick up the dead body. No fear of getting whatever disease it was that the person died from. And then take the body out to bury it properly. It's a relative's job to bury the bodies, not somebody else's necessarily job to bury the bodies. If you are a priest and you don't have the option of you physically doing it, you find the nearest relative, this person who can do so, or you hire someone to take care of the body and do it for you. You are still there. That was commonly done. It still is in many parts of the world today. A person's sick or they're dying, they left their own home to live out their lives. The idea of hospitals, that's a new thing. The idea of bringing them off and carrying away to some other place and let them take care of them until the body passed away, that's a new idea. That's not part of God's experience or what he intended. Why would he not design things that way? Well, if we remove ourselves from life and death, we don't appreciate it all that much. We can isolate ourselves. Oh, well, there's dead people over there, and I don't see them all the time. Well, if you were around dead people because their relatives are dying, you experience what life is truly, how difficult it may be. It appreciates the work that goes into it, how much important God values you as an individual. So when you're dealing with dead people, which is very common, because everybody dies, when they're around, it makes an imprint on you. I mean, how many of you have watched somebody die, just sat there and watched them die? It's not easy. But it makes a permanent imprint on you, doesn't it? You'll never forget it. Well, if you are never around someone who's ever died, you hear about a letter of telephone call, oh, so-and-so died, oh, that's too bad, I'll send a card. Whatever wins a funeral. That kind of thing, you are detached from the life of and the ending life of that person and how they lived. That was not God's intent. Life is supposed to be an interaction thing, both living and dying. It's never supposed to be separated as if they're always isolated. You are going to experience dead people. That's part of living. It's the nature of living. That's not necessarily a bad thing. What you do is how you handle the dead body and what you do with it then. Yes?
I would think also that if you have all these commandments that, you know, do this or do not do this or you will die, if you didn't have any concept of you will die, what's the point? I mean, if we shelter our children a lot, you know, today it's real common that kids aren't invited to funerals or they're not around it. And so if you were to give that child the Torah and tell them this is upon death, like, okay, what's death? You know,
right.
I don't know what that is. So I would think that it would be very important to have that instilled
thing.
In them, that this is what death is. This is why this is very serious.
What it looks like, what the experience
like.
Is. The person's
exactly.
gone. You yep. watch them get buried or whatever, however
exactly.
the process is taken care of. Yes, it's
yes.
the same idea. In the case of the high priest is supposed to be uniquely separated, so he's not supposed to experience a dead body, physically touched, that is, regardless of the situation or who it happens to be, unless, of course, it's himself. He touches on the dead body. But as far as sharing or contaminating himself with anybody else, and why would a high priest be eliminated or not be allowed to do this ever, even with a close relative? What's the high priest's job? For the Holy of Holy Place, the place that he carries the name of God with him at all times. Well, God is not where death is. He is where life is. So he is representative of life at all times. Even when there's death around him, he's supposed to center life. When Aaron had to run, which we'll read about that later, run amongst the plague that was coming and killing the people at the... I forgot which plague it was off the top of my head. Anyway, Moses told him, take your censer, take the incense burning censer, and run into the midst of the death plague that's coming on these people. Well, he's a live person. He's not to contaminate himself. Running toward danger and death. And he stands, as described, he stands in the midst between life and death. He stands there and stopping the plague. Well, that's the idea of life. Is that he brings life with him, not death with him. So he's not to bring death. He's also supposed to bring the idea of salvation and life with him at all times. That was the concept behind the high priest. That was his job was. You don't want him associating with dead people, dead bodies all the time, because he can't do his job. He'll be busy cleaning himself all the time and not doing your job for you. You'll have to focus on that he is a representative of God who is representative of life at all times. So his entire existence, the moment which he's anointed, is life. That's his only job, to represent life everywhere. Now, in Jewish tradition, they also point out the high priest, the way the scribes here, probably should not be even at a funeral for a close relative. They prohibit that function as well, just because I think it's enough close enough to the body that he should not be part of either. That's a separate detail, though. And he points out in verse 6, the reason all this problem is because you will desecrate God's offerings. If you contaminate your body, the high priest in particular, if he contaminates his body, what's he do? He contaminates every offering. Is contaminated. The person who offers it must be clean and holy. If you contaminate the offering, what happened to the person who brought the offering to you? Is it accepted? No, it's not. What if that person needed their offering accepted? They needed it. It was important for them and their lives, their families. It was important. And the high priest couldn't do it. Well, how would you like for your high priest, Messiah, to say, I'm sorry, I'm busy. I can't deal with you now. Your needs, they'll wait. I'm doing other things now. I'm preoccupied. What does that do to us? Talk about disheartening. It brings you very, very low. You don't want your high priest preoccupied with his own uncleanness instead of addressing your needs. To have your prayers unanswered, to have your needs unaddressed because he's busy. That's not what you want as a servant or a follower of God. Well, you wouldn't want your high priest to do it. You wouldn't want Messiah to do it. Therefore, don't do it. The offerings are more important. Your prayers, your offerings, your praises to God are more important than the dead people. That make sense? Okay. The various people, the high priest and priests in general are allowed to marry, of course, the opposite, the marry one who's been divorced or husband. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Sorry, just kind of, I'm reading through this. I was kind of trying to find the picture of Messiah in all of it. And it just kind of seemed to me like it's prophetically, at least, at the very least, twofold. You know, in one way, the people never see the high priest unclean.
Right.
So that's one picture of, you know, because Messiah was never unclean. And so when we see him, it's the same picture. And then also, Messiah didn't bring death. He only ever brought life. I mean, even the one time that you hear, well, I guess there were a couple, but the big time that you know about him coming close to contact with a dead person. He rose them from the dead.
Right.
So obviously God didn't imbue every single high priest with the ability to do that.
No.
But he did make a way for them to always be bringing life to the people instead of any fashion bringing death.
That was the idea. And in verse 4, the way my words may be different than yours, says, a husband among his people shall not contend himself to one who desecrates him. That is a reference to the high priest. Is that the high priest is that husband among his people. So the high priest is acting as your husband. That's his job. As if that's his representative job as far as in your life. Well, who's supposed to be our husband? The Messiah, right? Was with the bride, that's the whole idea behind it. So the high priest, you wouldn't want the high priest, most people not to contain himself who desecrates him. So one who desecrates himself is not to be contained. The high priest, the husband's job, is not to desecrate himself amongst those who contaminate themselves to him. The idea is to bring life, to bring your wife or your sense of your people up to a state of cleanliness and holiness at all times. That's your job. That's what a husband's job is. Which husband is not supposed to be a provider to his family as best he can? That's our job, right? Well, that's the high priest's job too. Provide for family. In this case, not for money or food, but rather for offerings for life. That's what the husband's job is. In this case, it's a high priest. It's always about life. Okay, so I won't go through every detail of this section. Obviously, we know some details, but no shaving your head and various other customs of the time for indicate mourning, cutting yourself, or doing various other components of signs of mourning. I won't go into all those details. As far as the who and what he can and cannot marry, what I want to jump down to is, where is it? Verse 14 and 15. A widow divorcee or desecrated woman, a harlot, he shall not marry. These only a virgin of his people shall he be take his wife. Thus shall he not desecrate his offspring among his people, by the Lord who sanctifies him. This is due to offspring. Yes.
Skip kind of quickly over that traditions of the time.
Oh yes.
I'm wondering how far does that go? I mean.
Sheesh. I don't know all the traditions. As far as shaving one's side beard, shaving one's head, and cutting yourself.
I don't mean that. Does that make it not binding? That's what I'm asking. Because it was a tradition of the people. The letter says those things. Are we modifying that or moderating that with the traditions of the time?
I don't think so.
That.
Well, it says do not. It says they shall not make a bald spot on their heads.
Yeah.
So don't shave off your head. They shall not shave an edge of their beard in the form of for this idea of mourning or a dead person. And their flesh, they shall not cut a gash.
Well, okay, we.
Is that what I mean? I don't think I feel
like. That's for mourning?
Yes, for mourning. When you sorrow that someone has died, a loved one. There was it's the idea of when somebody has died, you don't touch yourself with the body, and these are the things that you as a priest are prohibited to do. You don't get to shave off parts of your beard, indicating that you are in mourning. The idea is do not use these techniques to show others you are in mourning. The edge of the beard, general cutting, it is associated, it's listed on its own, and I can't remember what's listed off the top of my head, as you should not shave the edges of your beard, and it keeps on going. But this is the same thing, but it points out it's in the context of mourning and dead people. So it has been applied that it's referring to shave the edge of your beard refers to in mourning. Now, in modern day Orthodox Judaism, they say, no, it means to shave your edge of beard anyway, at all points. That's the long locks they have the side of the sideburns. It keeps goes yay long.
Easy commandment to keep.
Easy to keep. Don't shave it when you're in, you're not in mourning, don't shave it. Now, it's not to say someone can't be clean shaven, as a general rule. That's not part of the instruction here. The point is, in the idea of when you're in mourning and sorrow for whatever the case may be, don't go through the process of ritually showing that you are in mourning to everybody else. Don't go through that process. Now, we have a modern day variation. We have where we wear black. I'm in mourning for next 10 years because my husband or my wife died and I'm not going to marry again. So we're black the rest of my life. That's a common tradition in many cultures. That is an outward variation of the same idea. You are demonstrating that you are sorrowing and mourning all the time. It's not a positive thing necessarily. Not saying that God will condemn you for it. The point is, it's not necessarily a positive thing. That it takes out the spirit behind this, which is to not desecrate your body and not make yourself blemished or unacceptable. What's referring to priests in particular? Personally speaking, I'm in training to be a priest. How about you? I'm not anointed, but I'm trying. The idea is it would apply to anybody. The idea is that to accentuate your mourning state, what does that do to others when they watch you, when they see you? What does it do to them? Well, oh, they're mourning. My heart goes out to them. I'm sorrowful for them on their behalf. It does teach you about death, but the idea of it draws attention to you at the same time. That's not necessarily a positive thing. God intended attention always drawn to him. Now, when it comes to priests in particular, their job is to take the people's offerings, whatever they may be, and bring them up to God at all times. That's the idea. If he's blemished by artificially shaving his beard because he's in mourning, or he's cut himself, he's made a blemish on himself. We talk about later on the blemishes. You know, you can't offer if you have blemishes. Self-inflicted blemishes are just as bad as natural ones too. They're not acceptable actions or behaviors. So the idea of this idea of mourning or being in sorrow, there's nothing wrong with it. It has a limitation time period to it as well, because you can be sorrowful for someone who dies. Anybody can be sorrowful for someone who dies. But they want to know how you project that sorrowfulness is not in the form of what's listed here. Don't be shaving your head. Don't be shaving the side of your beards. Don't be cutting yourself. And also points out the high priest, don't rent your garments. Don't tear the garments you have on. Mind you, those are really high and expensive and hard garments to make. They're anointed garments. Don't do that. These are special circumstances things. You are a holy thing, the priest, and the things you wear are holy things. So watch out what you're doing. Make yourself look like and act like God. Yes, Rose.
What about when Moses died? Did not they mourn him for 30 days?
Yes, they did.
And also, is that the shortest period of time one should mourn a person and just get on with it?
Oh, I have no idea. Shortest period of time?
Yeah.
I don't think there's a mandate for that.
Okay.
If you mourn someone for an hour.
But I mean, didn't the high priest mourn Moses for 30 days?
Right, but what were they doing? Did the high priest rent his garments?
No.
No. The high priest shave his head?
No.
No. High priest shave his beard? No. Did anybody do anything of lists here to indicate for their permanent, you know, markings and blemishing themselves? No. Did the high priest still have to offer sacrifices and offerings in the 30 days? Yes. He still has a job to do. It doesn't make, oh, for the next 30 days, everybody, we're sinless. Try that. We're all sinless for 30 days. No offerings, no nothing. Good luck, okay? just try. I'll be easy. A group of like 10 people. Just a small group. 30 days. Good luck. No. So, yeah, no sin diet. I like that one. So, the point is that he still has offerings to do. He still has a job to do. He still has functions to continue on. Mourning doesn't mean your life ends. Your job ends. You are now excused from all your tasks. Mourning is you do not continue on with whatever project that is not necessary that you are doing. In the case of Moses, what were they mourning for? For the time period, what did they not do? They didn't cross the Jordan River. So they waited that time period and then let's go cross the Jordan River. Let's move on and get in the territory. That with the crossing the Jordan River, was that part of the high priest's offering sacrifices? No. Was he involved? Well, sure, they had to carry the ark and all that kind of stuff, but that wasn't part of his tasks of taking care of the people. Those taking care of people's processes, all the offerings, still had to be done all the time. So high priest, they have a very specific job. Watch your conduct at all times, even in mourning, even in sadness, because you're supposed to represent life and do the offerings. Who had their hand up? Somebody else did too. I lost them. You can still cry yourself to sleep at night. If I recall correctly, even Aaron, when his two sons died, Moses said, hey, there's an offer you were supposed to eat. And Aaron said, I'm in mourning, I can't eat. Now, not that other sons couldn't eat, but Aaron said, it would be more wrong for me to eat this food than it would be for me to not eat it. And Moses conceded, they're probably right. Now, does that mean he didn't accept the offering? That was the question Moses brought up. This is an offering to God. Is God not going to accept it because you didn't eat it properly? Well, Moses conceded, Aaron, in your mourning, your upsetness, that your sons have died. You didn't touch the dead bodies, you didn't contend with yourself, but you were mourning your sadness for them. You're choosing to not eat it. Moses claimed or perceived, or we get the idea that God accepted the offering anyway, even though Aaron didn't actually eat the offering where it was supposed to be eaten, because he was too upset with the loss of his sons. So there is obviously some wiggle room in how this is done. Now, did Aaron rent his garments? No. Did he shave his beard? No. Did he do anything that prevents him from doing the service assigned to him? No, he didn't. The eating is the only thing he didn't do. And since he shall be eaten in a holy place was the assignment. And he was not at the point or ability or mood to actually eat because he was too distraught, too upset. So obviously there is some wiggle room on how the mourning works. But that doesn't mean the offering wasn't offered. The sins still had to be taken care of. They still had to be, the process still went through. Just the eating the animals, only he didn't do. That was about the extent of it. Does that make sense? So there's some wiggle room there, but nothing that can prevent the offering to actually go through the whole process. No, not super so. Any other questions or comments? Okay, let's move forward. There's more stuff here that I want to talk about. Let's see here. The offerings, the animals, I want to discuss all the details, chapter 22, as far as the animal, blemished animals and that kind of thing. It does point out, no layperson shall eat the offerings given to the Lord and such. Note, this is the one major exception that the Messiah brings up. David did. What did he do? Do you remember? Say it a little louder. He ate something. What did he eat? David ate. And the Messiah points out, and those with him, I don't know how many there were. Obviously his men. Ate the showbread. Now, he points out if a layperson eats anything that is not permitted to eat by accident, what's his job? He pays back one-fifth of it. So he has whatever he consumed plus one-fifth is the paid to the high priest. David didn't do that, by the way, in case you didn't notice. In David's bed, he ate the showbread because he was hungry. They were traveling. They were trying to escape Saul. And the high priest said, this is all the food we've got. This is it. They had nothing else to give you. And David ate it, and he took it. Now, what was the high priest at David's time concerned with? What was his one question he asked? Have you laid with your wife? Any women? And David said, no, we've been traveling. I mean, none of the men for days. Has not been. And that was one thing he wanted to make sure, that you weren't contaminated by a woman at this time, the seminal emissions and whatever else goes on for at least up until sunset the following day, plus a bath. So that was his concern. The high priest asked that one question. David said, no, it was fine. We are not contaminated. And they said, here's the bread. You can have it. What was the high priest doing when he did that? Was he breaking the law? Yes. He did break the law. The law says don't do that. What was he doing instead? Make sure it wasn't unclean. So it was unclean as the high priest was focused on. Unclean. Was he still a lay person? Yes, he was not Jewish. He was not, sorry, he was not a Levite. He was not part of the high priest's family. When Saul came to that particular high priest and asked him the meaning of what had happened and what had gone on, and he could accuse the high priest of aiding and abetting Saul's enemies, the high priest said, wait a minute. He's your son-in-law. He said he was on your mission, doing your job, and doing a task. How was I supposed to know he was some deviousness was happening between the two of you? The high priest tried to defend himself. He had no idea that there was any problem between David and Saul. Well, the high priest was focused on the unclean idea. Once he found that David was not unclean, he said, all right, go ahead and eat it. Why did he do that? Why would he do that? Why would the high priest do that? Why would the high priest allow such a thing? Good. Your hands up. Go ahead.
Back there.
Go ahead.
I thought when Messiah talked about it, it seemed like as they were on a mission from God, and therefore they were acting in the like a priest.
In a manner of speaking, you could argue it that way. In that David's job, he had told the priest, I'm on a mission from King Saul to go do this. And Messiah likened that to being a commission, you're doing a job for God in that fashion. That is a way of viewing it. Any other thoughts or opinions on it?
Well, he was going to be the king.
He would be the king at some point, that's true. That's true. In the case of David, his anointing may or may not have been public knowledge at the time. I don't know. As far as it is, because he was anointed when he was obviously years younger. But I don't know how many people knew he was going to be king. But the high priest may or may not have known. I'm not sure, but he was going to be king. But in this way of doing this, what did the high priest do? Who's allowed to eat it? Priest and his family. And their family. Immediate family. What was the high priest symbolically doing when he made this distinction? He made this act. What did he do to David? Adopting David. That's a way in which you can do it. Now, this does not permit adopting David, but spiritually it's what he did. So the high priest, by making this rule, say, are you unclean or not clean? He's obviously unclean. He's doing a symbolic adoption.
Because kings weren't allowed to eat it either.
You know, kings couldn't eat it either. That's essentially what he's doing. High priest saying, I am incorporating you into my family. I am allowing you and your men to eat this bread. And as far as the high priest is concerned, that was acceptable in his eyes. God didn't strike him down for that. He died later for other reasons. For Saul killed him off. But this was not the issue that he was upset with. So symbolically, he adopted David. God does the same thing. In 1 Samuel chapter 10, God's telling David, I am symbolically adopting your son as my son. So I am making God's... In 1 Samuel 10, God is taking David and saying, I am making David a son of mine. We've adopted into the family as well. The same idea. So God, the creator God, says in 1 Samuel 10, he's taking David and David's descendants and take them as they are his people, his children. Now God had already done in the Old Testament, in the Tanakh, when he's taking the firstborn of Israel, he had stated, I am taking the Levites as my children. They are my firstborn. Well, he just did that to David too in 1 Samuel 10. So God's taking David and taking David, I am converting David from Jewish king over into Levite priest. Also known as a firstborn. So God did that to David. So this act that the high priest did for David as well, which happened earlier, this whole process, the idea is that the high priest was acting out the same thing that God promises David as well. He's taking David and making him into the family. Hence how a Messiah becomes a high priest, though he's not a biological Levite high priest descendant. But he's a descendant of David, though, and God adopted David. And David's action through the eating the bread demonstrated that the high priest was adopting him as well. So both of them, through David's physical life of eating the bread, as well as his spiritual life of God adopting him as his own personal son, indicates that this symbolically, it worked. Symbolically, God made sure it happened. It was still acceptable. Does that make sense? Not physically, but symbolically. Let's move on. I would jump to 23, the Holy Days. Let's see here. Since I can do that now. A nice, pretty board, nice, clean board instantaneously. Holy Days, Holy Day Offerings, 23. Any questions about 21 and 22 so far? Let's see, what you can and can't eat, all the good stuff. The offerings you can eat. So we have Holy Days. We have Shabbat. These are not every holy day listed. These are just the ones that are listed here, because new moons aren't listed here. After Shabbat, what does it go through? It goes through Pesach or Passover. And unleavened bread. Maybe that's you, N. N-E-N-D. Bread. After unleavened bread, what does it do? It goes through the feasts, right? It's the counting. Let's see, let's go through the weeks, the Omer, for 7 weeks. And after Omer, what's the next one? It says the Shavuot. Also, it's Pentecost, which is the seventh, the end of the last, the end, which is the 50th day. At Shavuot, it goes to trumpets. And at trumpets, of course, there's Atonement, also Yom Kippur, and then Sukkot. All right, those are basic holidays, as far as holidays are listed here. He does not do New Moon in this section. New Moon is listed at another place in the Torah. Obviously, when we go through every detail, we know these details. They're pretty obvious, because we're familiar with all of them. So Shabbat is the seventh day of rest, which God said, of course, is the eternal decree forever. Passover, the unleavened bread, is 7 days for unleavened bread. The first and the last are both holy days for unleavened bread. And Passover, of course, is the lead into that, the evening up to, leading up to the first day. The Omer is obviously 7 weeks long. And the Shavuot is the culmination, the end of the seventh week, in the day following the seventh week, day after seven. At seventh week. And then we have trumpets, the first day of the seventh month. And then we have atonement, the 10th day of the seventh month. And then we have Sukkot, which is 7 days long. Now he also brings up the eighth day as well, the end of Sukkot being the eighth day being a holy day. So the first day is a holy day, and the eighth day, the day after Sukkot, is also a holy day. He doesn't end here. This is a whole section about sevens. So that's all chapter 23. Chapter 24 also talks about the menorah. How many candlesticks are on a menorah? Seven. Seven lights. Which is done how many times? Every day for a week. So it's seven lights for 7 days. As he points out, it's a weekly event that they take care of the Torah. He also does the showbread. And how many loaves of showbread? There are 12. For how many days do you recycle it? Every seventh day. So there's 12 loaves for 7 days. See a theme? Okay. Hope you see a theme so far. We're not done yet, though. It jumps to a blasphemer. God doesn't end with the seventh cycle. Actually, the next section, which Jeff will be covering, talks about the seventh sabbatical year in chapter 25 and the seventh year jubilee. So we'll write this a bit too, because he'll talk about it next week. So there's a seventh year and seventh set of years. So all of these have a listing. Notice a theme? Seven, 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 over and over and over and over again. What's God wanting you to understand about seven? Seven's about rest. It's complete. It's the whole thing. Everything is all here in the seven set. So God's intent, when he lists all these things together in chapter 23, 24, and 25, he wants to get one idea across to us. Here's everything. Here's everything. This is all the stuff. It's all right here. And the beautiful thing about it is he notes the 12 loaves in it. What do 12 loaves represent? All men, 12 tribes of Israel. Everybody who follows God, either by biology, I'm a descendant of, or it says one law for proselyte and native born. So if you agree to follow him or you biologically follow him, this is everything you do. You got it? No mistakes, no ifs, ands, or buts. This is the package. This is what it looks like. So we look and say, well, there's a lot of stuff in there. Note what's not there. Yeah, Christmas isn't there. What also isn't there? Easter's not there either. Halloween's not there. Oh man, well, the fun days, right? There are a lot of things that aren't here. And why are they not here? They're pagan. They're not his. This is the way he wants us to obey and worship in this fashion. Not the fashion that we create, but the fashion he assigned. This is the way he wants it done in. It's not our own creation. Oh, well, he knows my heart. He really... No. No excuses. This is the example he said. He said it not just here in Leviticus. He said it many times throughout the Bible, again and again and again, and New Testament extensively as well. Let's jump there real quick.
Hey, if we follow all this, does that make us a legalist?
legalist. I'm pretty happy for here's the problem with legalism. This is what people get themselves mixed up in it. Salvation. The belief that doing these holy days in law, in the law, connecting that incorrectly to the concept of salvation. These on this list here of all these holy days in the Torah have nothing to do with the idea of salvation. That's an independent concept. These over here have to do with what's called life. It's how you live, how you do things, what you do, how you do them. That's the idea behind them, what they are. This, all these holy days, have nothing to do with being saved. So people confuse the idea of legalism. Oh, you're trying to get yourself saved by legalism. No. This has nothing to do with salvation. Salvation is strictly a gift. And what was the requirement to get it?
We're only in when Yeshua says we're in. Straight up. Right. We live the Torah to the best of our abilities, do what we believe through the scriptures is correct. And we don't get in. We're not saved until Yeshua says, hey, come on in.
Right.
That's
independent,
the bottom line.
Yeah, independent of stuff. This salvation was strictly a gift for me. You had to, what was the requirement? Believe. I before E. I knew that. Except to see or a neighbor wave their height. There are more exceptions than I can think of. Sorry, I'm a terrible speller, right? I'll blame the English language. It's a good excuse. So the idea is the gift is belief, but the belief has one condition. Do nothing, which means it's not your work. Do nothing, which means your actions don't get you your gift. It's your belief that gets it to you. Moses pointed out, salvation has to do nothing. Moses said very, very well. You want salvation? Do nothing. You want to live? Here, do this. You want salvation? Do nothing. Messiah said, you want salvation? You have to believe in me. Are you doing anything? No, you're believing. This is where the salvation is. That's a gift for the belief. Life, how to live, that's over here.
Which one of the apostles said that I show my belief by my works?
Yes,
who
James.
Said that?
Mm-hmm. How do you show your belief? Yeah, what you do is how you live your life. It's not through following the law of the Torah. It's how you live your life. What life did Messiah show, or what example did he give us? Well, there was forgiveness, there was justice, there was mercy, there was... Are any of those things requirement for, have anything to do with the 7 weeks of, you know, first fruit? Or Shavuot? No, those aren't mercy issues. These are living, how you live your life. Salvation is independent of that, yes.
So, I understand, you know, that we're being given these ways to celebrate and to worship. But it seems, you know, in my reading, that there's actually very little said about the specifics of what to do with each one. And it seems that, you know, like Christmas, we've added a lot of traditions that are extra scriptural.
Well,
I guess what I'm asking is, you know, are we given the freedom to create our own traditions within each of these to a point?
Right. Yes and no. Yes, there are certain things you do that they're required. But then anything beyond that is what you choose to incorporate, which is nothing, as long as it's not against God's instructions. So, for example, on Shabbat, just for example, some of us, not everybody, have a Shabbat meal or a dinner leading up to the evening before, as it's coming in, we have a meal together. And we lift up bread, we lift up wine, we wash our hands, whatever we do to honor or bring in the Shabbat. My family, we even dance too. So, are any of those required for Shabbat? No. Are they evil? No. Are they against the Bible? No. There's nothing wrong with them. They don't break anything. That's an important concept. Don't break the Bible to do it. Don't break the Torah to do it. But bringing them in is not necessarily evil. Now, if I did Shabbat and said, okay, I'm going to play golf. I hate golf. So I use the example all the time. I'm going to play golf on Shabbat. Is that evil? You might be pushing that. That's potentially because golf has nothing to do with sanctifying the day of Shabbat, is it? It's going off and playing a game. I'm entertaining myself. That's not what God intended. When God intended Shabbat, he said you will keep it holy and keep it separated. Now, does God say on Shabbat, you must go to church?
Oops. Church is two H's. Church.
No, he doesn't. Is it evil to go to a church or synagogue on Shabbat? No, because you're learning about God. You're still learning things, still doing things. So he didn't say go, but is it evil to go? No, it's not. Is it against the Torah to go? No, it's not. Is the tradition added? Yes, it is. Well, who added it? Well, actually, the Hasmoneans added most of it.
We don't. Not to take the assembly of the soul.
Right. And that's where next events come in. A lot of these have additional assemblies that have been put on, aren't evil. They are traditions. They're not necessarily wrong, but they are traditions. Hold on, I got three hands up. Go ahead, you go first.
I just wanted to say that, you know, if God looks down and sees us, we're all believers, we believe, we've received the gift, and we're keeping all of these things, but we're not loving our neighbor, and we're being rude, and we're being, you know, selfish and miserly, then somebody who hasn't yet come to a belief in the fact that these things are still for today, and they are being loving, and they are being generous, and they're laying down their lives, but they haven't yet come to this knowledge, who's going to stand before the Lord and have greater works?
Ah, I mean, if you're speaking in both ways, but neither do it both do at the same time. It's a funny mix. No. Yeah, I get that. I'll do my best to explain this as simply as in my head, how I picture it. I can be wrong, but it's how I picture it. So when it comes to your actions, the weight of your matter is the law. You got justice. There's mercy. What else are there? Justice? Mercy. Righteousness, thank you. Okay, don't harass me. That's not fair. Just gonna put them. Oh, whatever. Yeah, okay. I'm not gonna worry about whether I wrote them in the right order. They're just what they are. So justice, mercy, righteousness. Humble. Hold on a minute. Humbly. Humble. Close enough. The weightier matters of the law. Now, I have a question for you. Can a person do these, the holy days and all the Shabbats and all the... and not do these? This is a trick question.
Well,
and not do these.
They would be fulfilling part of it.
Part of it. Now,
they would be fulfilling part of
there's
it.
There's more to it than just that. In the seventh year and in the 50th year, the Jubilee year, where do those come in? You can't observe those two and not observe mercy. It's impossible because those two require it. So the point is that if a person is observing these the way they were written, and by definition, inside their hearts, their minds, they have mercy, they have righteousness, they have justice, and they're humble. Because now, if they choose to observe these on the surface only and have no actual meaning behind anything, which is they're not observing them anymore. You see, you can observe something on the surface, but if you're observing on the surface, you're not actually observing it. You're faking it. You're pretending. Make people look at you, look as if you're observing, but you're really not. If you're not really observing them as the instructions are in the Torah, then you're not doing any of these things. And as a result, you're not actually observing them anyway. So someone who observes them is doing this if they're truly observing it. If they're not observing it and they're faking it, well, that's what Amos railed against. You guys are faking this. You're going about trying to say, hey, when will the Shabbat go, when will the sun go down so I can buy and sell again? They're observing it by surface only. They're not observing it at all. As Amos railed against them, you don't observe anything. You guys are corrupt. You're evil. You're disgusting. God's throwing you out. You obviously have no comprehension of him at all. That was what they were against. And of course, Jeremiah reiterates the same thing. So does Isaiah. So does Hosea and a few others. They all say the same thing. You did a few of the surface items and you purposely took away all the parts that were supposed to be built into these as the instructions are. When you take away the parts of justice, mercy, righteousness, and humbly, then you aren't doing any of this stuff. You're a liar. You're a hypocrite. You're an actor. This is the detail. When you're doing these tasks, justice, mercy, well, it's difficult as far as what you define righteousness, all kind of stuff. I won't go through every detail of somebody's personal definition, what they think righteousness is or isn't. When you're doing these tasks and not doing any of these, I would call you normally, I would call you a Sadducee. But a person who knows God but doesn't know scriptures, doesn't know God in what he said, but knows him in the idea behind him, which Sadducees are really good at. They knew nothing about scripture, but they knew what the intent was, to try to follow God and try to build a nation to do something and be proactive and help people out. That was their comprehension. But their comprehension of scripture itself was extremely limited. And this reason why they're all gone. So the Essenes had even a worse problem. And the Essenes filled the scriptures as best they could, purposely subtracting out sections. In the case the Essenes took out part of that and took out humbly really, really well. They took out sections of it to replace or reshuffle the meanings behind them to fit their needs. Those are both examples of people who don't know the scriptures at all. But they understand that there's a God. Now, note, the detail of salvation, believing God and doing, it had nothing to do with your actions, believing God. This is still a gift. Whether someone is living the life over here or not. Because note, when Moses brought them out of Egypt, were the Israelites observing any of these things? Not at all. But did they receive salvation? Well, yes, they did, through the Red Sea. It worked really well. They got the salvation independent of their actions. All they do is just stand by and watch. So salvation was independent of these. So anybody who observes mercy, justice, righteousness, humbly, and believes in God, they have their salvation. Now, do they have their understanding of life? Not quite. The understanding of what life is, what life means, is not developed yet. That's between the time with them and God working with them to however he wishes to bring them. I do recognize there are many people who this style of life with the holy days and such is beyond their ability to comprehend or do in their life. It's too much for them. I respect God's decision to say, I'm not going to allow this person to go any further. They're fine where they're at. They can't take anymore. I respect that. That's his decision, not mine. Thank goodness. So that's fine. That's God's choice. These items, justice, mercy, and humility, and by you, these items are all listed in the Torah and instructions of what they look like. But if a person is doing these things, mercy and justice and righteousness and being humble with their God, it's hard to do those things without comprehending or reading any of the instructions of how to do them. But that's just my opinion. But we can have differences of opinions on how someone observes justice and righteousness and mercy if they don't read the text that God said, this is what justice looks like, this is what mercy looks like, this is what righteousness looks like. It's hard to define those things then in that particular individual person. But they have to make that decision on their own. I can't make it for them. You have to side out to. I don't have the Bible memorized. Sorry.
For when the Gentiles, which are people who are not part of the family yet, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, not having the law, are a law unto themselves.
Which is a good way of wording it. Thank you. Who else has their hand up? Yes.
I was just going to say that the scribes and Pharisees of Yeshua's time were the same as what you were explaining in the Old Testament times. That things hadn't changed. They're doing all of this, but it's just like they're just doing it, and they don't have any heart at all.
In many ways, that is true. If you'll notice, people don't change. No. The same people, Adam and Eve, today, okay, yeah, we don't live as long, but reality is our thoughts, our beliefs, our opinions, the human mind hasn't changed. We still think the same things. We still act the same way. We still have the same opinions, still the same thoughts, still the same actions. Nothing changes. So you have the mental state of the people back in Moses' time or Messiah's time or in today's time. Nothing's different. We're all the same people. We all say the same because we all go through the same lessons. What is mercy? What's kindness? What's justice? What's love? What all those things are, we have to learn and figure them all out. God's in, and by shoving these particular holy days and all these events together and all the point of sevens and repeat it over and over and over again in chapter 23, 24, and 25. I didn't read 25, of course. That's next chapter. But the idea is that you show them all together as in a complete package. If you observe these things, note, by the way, these things have more stuff to them. There are instructions on what Shabbat looks like and how you do it. It's listed in certain different spots along the way. There's instructions on what passive looks like and how you observe it. There are instructions in other parts of the Bible just detailing what it looks like. Also on the red, there's more instructions on what this looks like. But the idea of these components being part of your observance of Him, this is the way He wants to be worshipped. The way He wants it to be done. Not the way we want it to be done, the way He wants it to be done. We put our own stuff in, which is pointed out earlier. Christmas, Easter, the tree, whatever else you can think of. We put a lot of stuff in there. All those, that's not how you worship me. Now in Deuteronomy 12, as well as a few of the spots too, he points out a few times. Maybe 12, it's also getting in 14. He also says in Exodus 34, it says, do not use or observe or take. Observe. Use, observe, or take any of the components, tools, or mannerisms. So the Canaanites. So the parts, the methods of Canaanites. Of Canaan. And use them to worship me. It's H. It worship me, your God. So, when we look at these things, and as Daniel was asking, we add traditions into it, but they aren't necessarily against the Torah. His instructions are repeated over and over again. This is Deuteronomy. This is in 12, there's 14, there's also Exodus 34, and I forgot all of them. There's a few of them. He says, don't take the traditions that you observe in the world around you and the ways which they worship their God, don't bring them into my stuff.
No blue Christmas tree with stars on
them. No blue Christmas tree with stars on them. Now, there's lots of traditions that man has added in their own way of doing things. The tree is not a new thing. It's been around thousands and thousands of years. And Jeremiah even talks about it. So it's been around a long time. But the point is, don't take these components and apply them to your worship of God. Now, here's a detail. Even if you take these components and say, well, I'll just do them and not apply them to this stuff over here. I'll just do my own. Same problem applies. You still do the same thing. In that, in which case, he points out, I think this is actually specifically in, I think it's 12 that actually talks about that. That talks about, do not actually observe their techniques in any way in your worship of God. So I say, well, okay, well, God, you have these holy days, there's a bunch of them. I'll just choose some other arbitrary date. I'll choose a January 3rd. And I'll take that day, and I'll go ahead and I'll take one of these other methods I see the pagans do, and I'll use that and I'll worship God on January 3rd also. It doesn't make a difference. Same principle, yeah. That's also against the instructions. So taking something of what they do and say, well, I have this in my hand. If I like what they do. Oh, it looks like lots of fun. I like rabbits or eggs and whatever else. I won't contaminate any of God's holy days, but I'll just make my own. I'll make a new one. No. That was what Jeroboam was killed for. Jeroboam was killed for doing that precise thing, for taking what other people have done, or actually what he did. He took, in this case, he took Sukkot and the 7-day long celebration. So I'm going to take and suck out of that from God. I'm going to bring it over here and move it a whole month later. And on top of that, I'm going to take a bunch of people that I think really like God, in my opinion, I'm going to make them my new priests. And I'm going to take the idols that the pagans have, because they're really cool looking, I'm going to add them on too. There are two calves. And I think it was 17 years, I think it is, before God killed him. It's a long time. So he was taking chunks of God's instructions and taking chunks of the pagans and shoving them together in a new holy day. And said, hey everybody, let's do this. God said, this was the sin of Jeroboam. He killed him for it. He killed his son first, made sure he watched his son die, and then he killed him for it. But the whole idea, he wanted to make sure that this is very corrupt and evil. The idea of mixing and matching, this isn't a deck of cards where you're shuffling together. This is a set that God wanted done in the way he wanted it done, not in the way which we think or project or manage in our own imaginations of what we think should happen. So it's important we understand that there's reasons that God shoved these together, and here's their list, here's their chunk of the actions. Not that one. Chunk of the actions of what he wanted people to follow and how he wanted his life and how he wanted his existence to be celebrated and worshipped. Does that make sense? Hopefully it makes sense. Any questions so far? Yes.
It just seems like the way that he has it set out makes it harder for you to fake it, you know?
Hard for you to fake it. It's an interesting way of putting it. That's true. Yeah, it'd be hard to fake it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, fake being kind, fake having mercy.
Oh, right.
And
it's impossible to fake those things. But that was the idea. Now, as I forget who it was, somebody pointed out, maybe it was Deanne did, that in Messiah's time, there were a number of Pharisees, not everybody, mind you, but a number of them who were in charge, who were good at faking it really, really well. And they acted out the instructions. They didn't add new stuff to it. But they then took the instructions and embellished them beyond the instruction given. So they took it, okay, well, the citation that Messiah gave, he gave a few of them, but I'm going to cite just one of them. He used the tzitzit. With these little tassels, as far as making them long and make it and sit at the nice place at the table, so at the banquets, the various holy days, the idea of taking these instructions and let's stretch them out to their extreme to get myself more attention. Note, in any of this stuff has anything to do with you and people attending or watching or observing you? No. Do any of these things have to do with anything of people watching and observing you to follow you? Is that what these things are designed for? No. Who is the objective to follow in this? The God, the Creator. So anything that draws attention to you will subtract attention from Him. Does that make sense? So an actor draws attention to themselves and subtracts attention from what's going on. It's no different than a magician. You know, look at the birdie. I'm doing something over here you can't see. Look at the birdie. He doesn't want you to see what he's actually doing. He wants you to look at the birdie, right? To distract your attention. The same idea. Same problem happens. It can happen to anybody. You have the appearance on the outside, but as Sharon pointed out, the internal part... I erased it already. Oh, no, I didn't. It's over here. None of the internal parts were actually real. They're all fake. So you can fake it for a period of time, but it doesn't last long. Don't get me wrong. I'm not railing against the Pharisees. They did some great, great stuff. It's called education. They taught people what the Bible said, which was amazing. Nobody else did it before. Yes. Tell me what Bible actually said.
I was going to say that actually being able to look at it like this today, I'm seeing that there can actually be a danger of not at least looking at how the Jews who observe these things, because they did put into practice a lot of things that really kind of keep the heart in it. And then kind of along with that is talking about some leadership that had kind of basically what they did was they went so far with their fences that they actually made it to where you could control your flesh and not have to worry about what's in your heart. I mean, that's really, it was like they manufactured a whole new system that just controls the body, mm-hmm. where if you just keep it down to the brass tacks and the more meaningful traditions that the Jews keep when they observe, you can't really fake that. You know, it's near impossible. If you start manufacturing those external controls, that's when that becomes possible.
Yep. It does become, it becomes very difficult. See, other sections talk about, let's see here. I won't go, I have other notes here I won't list today. Any questions so far about what this whole, what I'm trying to point out to us and share amongst all of us, is the idea is that, all right, God has his ways. He likes the way he wrote them out. He wants it his particular way. Yes?
So there's seven festivals, right?
Well, sort of. There are a lot of components to seven festivals. So you have Shabbat is considered a festival. Well, it is a day of convocation of which you gather together and no work. So it's a time period which you designate to God. These festivals is not really a good word for it so much as it is appointments. Yeah, all of them are appointments or moed or moedim, appointed times. So Shabbat is an appointed time. There's one. Passover is one. Unleavened bread is one. The 7 weeks of Omer is one, Shavuot is one, Trumpets is one, Atonement is one, Sukkot is one, and, which I didn't write here, Sukkot, that the eighth day is called the Shemini, or the eighth day. That's an M. Shemini is also a part of, but also indistinct from Sukkot. So this is one here and there's one there. What the seven, Sukkot is 7 days dwelling in a booth. Seventh day you take the booth down, the eighth day there's no booth. But it's still the same event. So, but the way the Bible is right, has it worded, at times it broke them into two separate events in the Torah, and sometimes it shoved together as one. So it's kind of a mixed one and a half or two almost there. Then you have, menorah is not one, showbread is not one, but the seventh year isn't a festival, but it's still an appointed year, appointed time. You also have, of course, the seventh set, which is, of course, Jubilee. So this is the Shemitah, is the seventh year. Yes, and the Shavuot, or sorry, Jubilee is the seventh year. Ring a bell. The seventh year, you bless the land, you also, your slaves go free, the various things that happen in the seventh year of rest, and the Jubilee, everything returns to its own original owner, and things of that nature. So you have debts and things released. All these are appointments. They're all appointments. So you've got, the Shabbat is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I would argue 10, 11. I would argue 11. You could probably do 12 if you pushed it. You could probably find a 12th one. I'm not sure. But the point is that these are all appointments. There's only one additional appointment added in the book of Acts. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, there's one additional appointment that isn't listed here, and that's New Moon.
Oh, you're right. That's right. New Moon. I forgot about that. The New Moon's not even on this list. I forgot about New Moon. You're right. There is one
Well,
more.
You could say the New Moon is on the list because they keep mentioning on the this month, day of this month, month, and there'd be no way to count it if there was no New Moon. Yeah.
And there were 12 New Moons. You're right. That would make 12. So New Moon. But New Moon's not listed in Leviticus. It's listed in Numbers and I can't figure who
it's
else.
It's hinted at, like Jeff said. It's kind of hinted at.
Because you have to know the month is. Yes.
But the deeper point is that you know, Rashi has an interesting theory as to why the Shabbat is listed with all these days.
Oh, God.
He says that the Sabbath is mentioned with the festivals to teach that anyone who desecrates the festivals is regarding as if he had desecrated the Sabbath.
Yep.
And therefore vice versa.
Yeah.
So it kind of gets you that point of how the church has, you know, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, for example, says, oh, we need to keep Shabbat, but all those festivals, those aren't necessary. Right. They stand or fall together.
They're all jumbled together.
And that's kind of what Rashi is kind of hinting
when,
at here.
In Deuteronomy, when it talks about the Ten Commandments are listed, I think it's chapter 6, 5, or whatever the chapter is, I can't remember. And then the rest of the book designates all this time. But it reaches the Shabbat chapters regarding the Fourth Commandment. He lists a whole bunch of these holy days. They're all jumbled together as one massive package. They all come as one thing. You break one, you break them all. There's no point in, you know, throwing them all out. So New Moon is one. That's the 12th one. But there's one more the apostles added in Acts 20, chapter 20, verse 7. They pointed out, which is actually, I shouldn't say added. Joshua did it too in the book of Joshua. And a few of them did it along the way. The first day of Omer is not a holy day, like a day off, don't work. But it does point out here, he spells out, you will wave the wave sheaf offering. So in that particular day, when the apostles were dealing with it, as well as when Joshua dealt with it after Moses, is that the people themselves broke bread together. Yeah. Yes, that's first fruits. That's recorded in Acts chapter 20, verse 7. It was the tradition. mind you, the English Bibles say he met the first day of the week. That's garbage. It says they met the first of the weeks, which was their tradition, the first of the weeks, plural, not singular. It is the first day of first fruits, which you break bread together. Because the instruction was, in the Torah, we just read it, you are not to eat the grain until the wave sheaf offering has been done, the new grain for the year. You can't eat it, you can't touch it. Well, you can touch it, you can gather it, but you can't actually consume any of it. So that was a big event. So, oh, now we get to eat the new stuff, because the old stuff, well, it's old. The new stuff tastes better, right? New is always better, right? So that was, it wasn't an addition, but it was a modification in the manner which, Daniel had asked, a manner which they observed the 7th week cycle, the 7 weeks of the Omer, as they distinct the very first beginning day where they're waving it, they actually got there and ate the new bread on that particular day. They started eating, and then they could eat from that point onwards. So I wouldn't say it's a holiday added, but it is a tradition put into it that allows you to observe the instruction here that you don't eat it until it gets waved. So it's a manner or a tradition in order to observe the instruction. Most traditions are. There are manners or ways which you can observe something, how it's taught. Most are done that way. So everyone says it's addition, but it's an instruction added to it. Almighty God, a great Heavenly Father, thank you for the Shabbat, a day of rest. Thank you for teaching us, for showing us what is good and bright in your eyes. Father, help us to appreciate the kindness you show us, the instructions you give, that we teach our children and grandchildren what is right and what is holy in your eyes. Help us to appreciate, Father, help us to not modify in our own likeness, our own image, your ways. For we are to be like you, not you like us. We praise you, Father, and ask your blessing on the rest of our Shabbat in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.